Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And so Cindy and I are digging into the relatively sensitive topic of, especially for people in our field, in the restaurants, of ratings and guides and what are the criterion behind these things. The thing that's really interesting to do is to see if, when you're in the business, you open the new guide of whether it's Forbes or the Michelin guide or whatever it might be, and you want to see if you've been mentioned, how you're mentioned. You know, that's always the big thing. It affects what's going on in your business. But as a person traveling to a place, it's a huge thing, right?
Definitely. Well, it's so helpful for people to have something to guide them. That's why it's called a guide. So, absolutely.
Are the criterion given for the Forbes guide? Do they state that clearly somewhere?
I didn't find it.
I know you're
it
researching all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I didn't find anything. So, I know that the difference with the information that I saw on the Michelin guide is that if you are going to be considered for 3 stars, the most stars, you know, they come in once a month, which is amazing. I was surprised by that. That's good. I mean, I think if you're going to give your opinion about something, you really need to know what you're talking about and whether it be good or bad, and you need to be as informed as possible. So the more they eat, the more they're going to really understand the restaurant.
So the tricky thing for us is we're giving our opinion about how opinions are given.
I know. It's a rather delicate thing that we're doing right now. And
but I think it's a conversation that's important
to
have.
Yeah, I think.
Mm-hmm. And the thing in the end, I know in your heart, you just want people to go, if they're going to choose to go to a restaurant, that they enjoy the heck out of it.
Absolutely. I just want everyone to be happy.
And that they get what they would hope for, maybe more than what they would hope for. And it's not like, oh, this person got this amazing deal. This person got taken care of well. This person got fed really well. Mm-hmm. This person had the kind of experience that they would hope for.
Absolutely.
In that space. I recall speaking to a woman who's a writer for travel guides. And she came in and had a cocktail in one of the restaurants and said, oh my gosh, this is a nice glass. I can't believe I'm not getting a cocktail in a mason jar. This must be Christmas.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You know. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain, like, they're like runaway things that happen in the culture. And sometimes there are people who are just reporting it in a journalistic way. And then sometimes people like to drive it.
Yeah.
But that's criticism, and that's different from lists. So give me and give listeners an idea of kind of who's making the lists, you know, in these moments in time. Like the Michelin Guide, the closest thing to Baltimore in the Michelin Guide is New York, right?
Right.
So,
well, they
so who are the places, you know, as a chef reading through the top tiers of the Michelin Guide, so what's in style? Because to me, oftentimes that speaks.
Well, it's predominantly, it's still molecular cooking based. It is, or avant-garde cooking, whatever you want to call it. I mean, we have, again, I started cooking in 1983, so I've been cooking 31 years, and I have seen a tremendous change in what has happened to food in our country over those 30 years. And the influence of molecular cooking is no longer an influence. It is a way that people cook. That's the biggest change, is that it used to be the classic French fundamentals were the foundation for most, you know, unless you were doing an Asian restaurant or a Mexican restaurant.
Whether it's French fundamentals or Italian or
right.
Essentially European fundamentals of cooking.
Exactly. And that was the foundation of, you know, when I went to culinary school, how we were taught to cook.
Is a better title molecular cooking or manipulation?
I don't even want to answer that question. You know? I'm not getting into that.
Right?
But it's
a definite style. It's a definite
style. Or you can say
style.
Scientific. Or you can say it's scientific based, because that's
absolutely.
In the end, that's what it is.
Absolutely.
It's food that is, you know, you're taking something and changing its shape and its form.
I think that it is reasonable to think that someone artistic also is scientific. You know, art has gone from purely just say for painting paint on canvas to people doing all kinds of light installations and all kinds of different, there are leaps made in art. And I think it is, you know, and of course, you know, and I know that you admire Ferran Adrià
absolutely.
For his artistic mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are absolutely leaps made in cuisine that have to do with an artistic mind and a scientific mind and how those things come together. And I think there's very interesting and very clever things that happen. But I think in a little bit, I talked about this on a different program, there's a continuum of entertainment versus an axis of satisfaction. And the question, the thing that to me missing most in ratings is, they said that word category that was in the one-star rating didn't exist in the two or the three. And to me, the category is super and duper important. There has to be some way to give a data point to how much the restaurant's cooking is dedicated towards entertainment and how much is dedicated towards satisfaction and traditional beauty. You know, mm-hmm. For a diner, that would be incredibly useful to be able to find something on that grid. So you know what? This is the kind of day I'm having today. Is there a one star that I can find in the Northwest Quadrant? Because that's going to make me happier today. Does that make sense? I think that to me is the thing that kind of misses on a lot of these things. And a lot of times for myself, I tend to categorize a lot of things, and I tend to organize a lot of things in my head and lists and memorize things. And it always comes down to exactly how much entertainment and exactly how much just gustatory happy I want to be. And they're very different things.
They are. Well, and you dine out for also a million different reasons. So
exactly right.
That's part of it as
exactly
well.
Exactly right. And that's the other thing that doesn't get taken into account on that list, because if you look at, so there are a lot of remarkable restaurants on the three-star list, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So who's landing there these days?
So in New York, it's the three stars are Chef's Table at Brooklyn Fair. And then you have 11 Madison Park, Jean Georges, Le Bernardin, Massa, and Perse. So those are the three stars.
And the interesting thing, a couple things that are interesting to me, is that you have things that land in style largely between France and kind of molecular Spain, but you have very classical origin restaurants that have gone down very, more molecular paths, manipulative paths, and
mm-hmm.
and I've been lucky enough to eat in just about all those places. But I'm surprised that there's not a different way. I know there's some, like Gomilo in France. There's a modern and traditional sort of like classification, just basic.
When
you look
in
their guide, yeah.
Oh, that's good. I didn't realize that.
When you look in their guide, the red ones are all the modern ones. And the black ones in print are all the traditional ones.
That's helpful.
And yeah, just that one simple thing.
Definitely.
Is very helpful.
That's a pretty big distinction like you're talking about, so that's cool.
Yeah, but the Gomilo doesn't help us much in the States.
No, right.
But that would be very helpful. Because how many people go from our city to New York and they want to go for a weekend and they want to see a show and they want to go to a very fancy meal, they want to go to a more relaxed meal or maybe a more satisfying meal, or they're eating Cousin Ernie from Syracuse that only wants good steaks, and it's kind of
right.
Like that makes the guide a lot more helpful if you have a little bit better idea. But if it's only if it only ever states within its category, I struggle with that.
Well,
what are the categories?
Right. Well, and the two stars are Aquavit, which the year before only had one star, so they went up a star. Aterra, which is maintaining two stars. Blanca, which was previously a one star. Danielle was a three star, and they put him down to two. And then
he's gone back and forth a couple of times, I think, in all of his ratings. His New York Times reviews, before the Michelin Guide, the New York Times review, he went up and down like three different times.
Mm-hmm. Ichimura, previously one star. Murea, Momofuku, and Soto. So those are the two stars. And then there are 58 one stars. And they actually have another category, which is for inexpensive. Michelin does have a category for inexpensive restaurants.
Yeah,
it's called the Bib Gourmand.
Bib Gourmand.
Right, which is helpful. So they have to, given you. So in addition to the starred restaurants, 125 restaurants received the Bib Gourmand. I'm just reading from the Michelin Guide, meaning that it's one of the Michelin inspector's favorite restaurants for good value. The Bib Gourmand restaurants offer two courses and a glass of wine or dessert for $40 or less, excluding tax and tip. So that's super helpful. too.
That is super
helpful.
That's
a good category.
And the fact that they actually write it where they say it's one of the inspector's favorites.
That's cool. I like that.
Is fair and human, and I appreciate that, because in the end, I mean, it's people cooking for people. It's people serving people, and those that do it very artfully. You know, that's, and the question is, how do you want them to do it, and what style do you want them to do it? But those that do it with a lot of care and a lot of earnestness and a lot of skill, that should be noted. And that makes sense.
So you have the Wine Spectator Wines of the Year list?
Wine Spectator Wines of the Year list is it's something I know that affects retail wine sales enormously, or has historically. There's always an issue that comes out, and it ranks them. And the wines that make their top 10, because a lot of wine consumers, the most fearful consumers, are not like not just the people who go to the restaurants, but everyone's terrified that they don't know something about wine. You're never going to know everything about wine. Learning about it.
Mm-hmm.
A guide like that and a publication that accepts a mountain of advertisements, I think it's really, really hard to imagine that there's not a lot of editorial guidance on what is said and who is chosen and all that kind of business. I think they name a lot of wines that can be very interesting wines, but they name them for one market. It's a very funny thing to me. I'm always a little bothered when that list comes out. I don't know how you name something as Wine of the Year.
Especially when there's so many.
There are so
there's
many.
So many to pick 10. That's a daunting task.
I mean, I guess it's a little bit like Song of the Year or something in pop music, you know, but at least whoever does that choice of the Grammys, at least the Grammys don't take advertisements, or maybe they do. When we come back to Formidable Fun Food and Wine, we're going to get into a couple of personal lists. Top 10 dishes and top 10 wines all time. All of that and more, and probably a little storytelling on Formidable Fun Food and Wine.